Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the November edition of the Calabutta Review podcast. I'm Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
And joining us today is writer, poet, and playwright, and author of the recently released novel, Slater Orchard, Darcy Dennegan. Thanks for joining us, Darcy.
Thanks for having me.
So before recording this podcast, we had the pleasure of having a roundtable discussion with Darcy and a smattering of grad students. And I think, honestly, that's probably the way that we should lead into every podcast, because not only did we get away some of the preliminary questions of introducing ourselves and knowing one another, but also cut to the quick in some pretty interesting facets of writing, creative writing, MFA programs generally. And so hopefully we can just clue listeners in to midpoint in that conversation. Nonetheless, for those listening that might not be familiar with your work, could you tell us a little bit more about what you do and where you do it?
Sure. I live in Providence, Rhode Island, where I'm a playwright in residence at the Wilbury Theater Group. I also write poems and plays and a novel that may be an anomaly. And I'm a professor in residence at the University of Connecticut.
Mm. And we had the good pleasure of having you read alongside Ramona Ossible last night, one of our new fiction faculty members. And in that reading, or afterwards during the Q&A, you had mentioned that you haven't written a poem for a good long time. Obviously, this latest project is a novel. You are a playwright in residence and so are producing plays. Why is it that you've moved in these new directions? Do you have a good sense of what's nourishing about these other modes of thinking and writing, and maybe why poetry isn't at the moment?
Sure. I think the more that I love poetry and the more that I write it and the more poetry I read, the less I feel that I understand it or understand how to write it.
Yeah.
And especially thinking about poetry being sort of like the art of endings and white space and line breaks and like what poetry has that other genres might not have. I think the longer I go, the less I know about what I can do with those particular things. Of course, there's a lot more to it, but maybe I'm overthinking or something lately. But poetry seems absolutely impossible this year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And has that been reflected also in your reading practices? Do you find yourself turning less to poetry on the page from others?
I think a little bit. Although when I am, you know, I've been teaching, so I have been reading new books for that. And so this year I taught Layli Long Soldier's Whereas.
Oh, yeah.
And I just thought, oh, my God, this is doing everything. This is doing everything. And these poems are so, so smart, but so formally inventive. And they're, you know, they're everything that one would want from poems. That, you know, they're so personal and they're so political. We had so many good discussions in my class, arguments and discussions. So when I am reading a good book, of course, someone just gave me, what's her first name? Jimena Smith. She runs Noemi. Carmen Jimena Smith.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Her book has milk in the title. I don't even remember the title.
Yeah.
The poems are so good.
Yeah.
So when I read those poems, I think, okay, you know, I want to write poems. But I realize the poems I'm gravitating to are the ones in that book and in Whereas that are really made of sentences.
Yeah.
And I think sentences are what I'm interested in right now. And so I'm just going to go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Whereas is so rich in etymologies,
right?
And obviously,
yeah.
And you mentioned last night that your latest novel is an etymological journey as much as it is a narrative one. That informed a lot of your choices.
I wonder if we should try to describe a little bit the novel that you read from, because it was so much fun to listen to, so delightful and strange. But for folks who weren't able to be at that reading, I don't know how I would describe it. But how would you describe sort of the aesthetic of this book?
Wish we had Margaret here right now.
Oh, yeah. Margaret gave a wonderful introduction.
Margaret Brown, who's our social media coordinator at Colorado Review, one of our editors and a third-year poetry MFA.
In the absence of Margaret and her excellent introduction, I can do my best. To me, I'm thinking about the post-industrial movement. Mm-hmm. I live on the East Coast, and, you know, most of my state are, you know, as factories, you know, mm-hmm. along all of our rivers are a number of factories, mostly textile, but other things as well, mm-hmm. Leather, bleach, the sales bleachery. And so now I think, you know, when we think of, at least in Rhode Island, when you go outside and you're near a river, what you're thinking about is how many years it might take before you could actually step into it again.
Yeah.
Thinking about how many years until the people catching fish from there don't have to just throw them back and could actually eat them.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about like the eels that have survived in the Woonasquatucket River in Providence. They're these cool eels. If you throw chicken nuggets in, you can see them pop up. And, there's actually an artist who did this really cool project with chicken nuggets and a like underwater camera. So she got some good footage of the eels. So I was thinking about that and thinking about how it's all ruined, really. Everything's
yeah.
ruined.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't change that. But the novel was thinking about maybe changing some of the words and what words refer to. So the mm-hmm. mill that I'm writing about is Slater Mill, which some people call the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution, which is in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and the Blackstone River along that mill, which is, the EPA called it in the 90s one of the most toxic sites in America.
Wow.
I think it may still qualify for that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So thinking about how, and I live on Slater Avenue, thinking about the word Slater and what it connotes to me is like death and ruin and, I'm not even talking about its labor practices, which is another thing,
yeah.
Just an environmental legacy, and thinking about how you could change what that word connotes through a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on the East Coast in Massachusetts.
Oh, you did? Where?
A town called Westboro, but my family has ties. My grandfather has lived on Cape Cod for many decades, and I used to live with him for periods. And it's less contaminated there, but it's got to be a strange thing because I spent a lot of time in Rhode Island, and those folks feel very similar to me, to folks who live on Cape Cod. And that's like the way of living
mm-hmm.
is related to the water. And once you contaminate it, it's like, how do you live now? On Cape Cod, it's with fishing. I mean, it's called Cape Cod, and they fished out all the cod decades
right.
and decades ago. And then it was tuna, but we're fishing out all the tuna. And so pretty soon it's going to be dogfish. And it's, you know, this weird looking little shark thing. And that's the only thing that's left. And it's strange to look at the East Coast the way that it's sort of, I don't know, the people still feel the same, but that we ruined the place a little bit.
Yeah, I was in Wellfleet last summer, which is on Cape Cod, and they're famous for their oysters.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was, you know, reading all about the threats to the oysters and the oyster farmers on Cape Cod. But then one of the farmers was actually telling me that what we call Wellfleet oysters aren't Wellfleet oysters at all because they were overfished almost 200 years ago and they had to bring in others.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was like listening and thinking like, wow, we really know how to do something.
Yeah.
We're very effective. Very effective, very productive. But you know, I think that just the idea that Wellfleet oysters, which is a phrase that's, you know, this is what this is. That phrase itself actually is false.
Yeah, yeah.
And threatened at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. That the name is itself lying.
Yeah.
That the very descriptor by which we know it is untrue. I just, in my E210 class, in my Intro to Creative Writing class, taught my students Jamaica Kincaid's A Small Place, which is an exceptionally good piece of writing, obviously. But also it speaks to a question that we were talking about as a group at that roundtable upstairs about form. And form as a component piece and as a vital component piece, part and parcel of whatever is being written. And that is oriented in the second person toward an explicitly white audience, a tourist, a potential tourist audience. and interrogating exactly that phenomenon, that the food they're eating on that island is shipped from Miami, that it's nothing that's there is of that place except for the people that themselves are remnants of this terrible industry a generation before them. And so thinking about that piece as being a second person interrogative work, what in the novel or in your individual poems, in those pieces that are most getting at the environmental concerns that you just spoke about, how does that form articulate itself, and how has it articulated itself differently in terms of that necessity of who you're speaking to and what you're speaking about?
Well, I find it hard to speak to anybody in general about a lot of things, but about environmental issues in particular. And so in that novel, I was really just speaking to myself and thinking about, you know, how, I mean, it's about one woman, this cleaning woman, trying to make a small orchard in the dumpster area of this sort of, you know, ruined concrete mill complex. And, you know, in that sense, if I had been thinking about other people or directing it towards other people, I certainly wouldn't have written it that way, because as a human, I think that small local things are great, but I think the community is more important than any individual act. I think Providence has some really good things going on in terms of the environmental social justice movement.
Yeah.
Providence links those things, and they feel they need to be linked, and they need to be, you know, community wide. So, I mean, my book fails that. First of all, because it's all in a vacuum. But, you know, I think I don't think about a larger sort of audience or about a movement or a political thing or a public crisis. I mean, I do think about those things, but I internalize them, and this is a sort of a private meditation on the problem and not a solution in any way.
Yeah. As ever at Colorado Review, we have lots going on in addition to this podcast. The Center for Literary Publishing is pleased to announce that Brandon Krieg's Magnifier, chosen by Kazem Ali as the winner of the 2019 Colorado Prize for Poetry, is now available at the Colorado Review website under the Bookstore tab. Also there, listeners can find past winners of the Colorado Prize for Poetry, including The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter by Gillian Cummings, and selections from our Mountain West poetry series, including Adam Fagan's Furthest Ecology. The Fall-Winter 2019 issue of Colorado Review is available now for purchase at that same bookstore tab. To ensure that you're up to date with all the wonderful things going on here at the Center for Literary Publishing and Colorado Review, be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
I don't even know how to ask this question, really, because I don't know what I'm asking. But listening to you read last night, there was, of course, playing with language, but there was also kind of like, it felt cyclical, like the protagonist would keep coming back to the same moments and phrases and say them again, but then they would start to mean something different. And I guess I don't know what my question is, except that I've seen devices like that before, and I can be a little skeptical sometimes because I can't feel what work it's doing. But this felt just right, where it would repeat, but it didn't repeat too often, and it caused me to see it differently. And so I don't know what my question is, except that did it come out that way, or did you have to do a lot of sort of like shaving down of stuff to try to make that transformation happen without getting bogged down with that style?
Thank you. I like that non-question. I'm interested in that non-question. I think it's still bogged down. Even what I read last night, I made some cuts to the actual published novel.
That, you're kidding.
No, I'm not. So I don't think it's perfect. But I also as I mentioned in the roundtable, I really wrote it sort of for myself, for my own private, like, sense of self. And so I just stayed stuck every time until a door appeared. And so the cyclical thing that you're talking about is, you know, the mind kind of stuck in terms of the thought pattern and stuck in terms of any kind of available action until something small gives way. And that's what I was sort of tracing for myself.
Yeah, it's really kind of a wild experience to listen to because it, like, starts to hurt, I think. I kind of felt that, you know, you get back to the protagonist gets to the same thing. And I started to be like, ugh, like, how are we going to solve this with the protagonist? Like, what's going to happen? And I like, it's helpful to hear that it's until some small thing gives way. And it seemed like at moments in your reading, it was like a moment of humor. But because of the being sort of stuck in this moment, the humor, it was like funny, but that hurt too. It was like, that's not the solution. It's like a little thing has given way. It's really wild. I don't know if this will be helpful to people because you'd have to actually hear or read that chunk, I think. But in terms of a listening experience, but also trying to think about how to write, it was really something. I haven't really experienced something like that before.
I'm going to say thank you. I'm not sure it's a compliment. I'm just going to say thank you.
Yeah, no, yeah. I loved it. It was so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested in humor, and that could be something to talk about because, I think the only kind of humor I'm interested in is the humor that hurts. And I feel when I'm editing, not necessarily that book, but recent plays I've written, that when the humor is, you know, still really funny to me, that easy or unwounding, that it's probably a place I need to edit.
Yeah, because it's not sort of serving the core thing that the piece is doing.
Yeah. Actually, since we were talking about whereas, you know, there's that part where her daughter gets hurt and she laughs.
Yeah.
And then she says, you know, no, we cry when we're hurt. And, you know, and that's such a powerful moment in the book. And that's if you can cry when you're hurt, I think that's a very safe, obviously a safe, secure place for a child to be, but a safe, secure place for any of us to be. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the world we live in. And I think that humor is the safer way to cry.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in ways to enact that in writing.
And especially as you've just situated that question in producing plays, I'm sure that experience of introducing humor and introducing humor that cuts is fundamentally different when you are literally seeing an audience experience that humor or experience it in ways that you hadn't expected. I think all of us, if we're producing work that we're going to send to the world in some way or another, has to reckon with it being out of our hands. But in our conversations earlier, you spoke a little bit about this being a gesture yet more out of your control. It's in the hands of a director that might not be you. It's in the hands of actors that certainly aren't you. And it's going to be arriving for that audience through a few different channels that you just have to relinquish control over. What is that experience like in reference to those other modes of writing and thinking and communicating as you've experienced them before being a playwright?
Well, it's humbling, of course. Because you have other people willing to try to buy into your vision and your words and give their time and energy in a way that, it's different if you're giving a poetry reading. You're grateful for the people who came to listen, but you're the person who's standing there putting themselves out there. And with a play, it's this whole team of people who are putting their energy and putting themselves out there. And I mean, it's really humbling and kind of mortifying, but it's also exhilarating. And now I forget your question.
Just the texture of difference.
As opposed to just writing. I love to watch Netflix like late at night and numb myself. And or if I'm awake and with people, I love to watch like a good movie. And obviously I love to read. But in terms of like TV and film, like it feels like you're watching a ghost right? Or mm-hmm. even with a book, it's like even books that are so alive to me, I have a degree of freedom to put them down or to go back. And there's something about a play. We're all breathing in the same room. We're all stuck here.
Yeah.
And we're all kind of working together. Even the audience, like we're all kind of working here. Mm-hmm. And it's just, wow, it's so cool. And it feels more and more to me like, even if it's not a play necessarily, but that kind of sort of alive collaboration is what is where I want my writing to go towards. I wouldn't even call it an endpoint because, you know, I think, you know, that energy, even when the play is over, that energy into making it and being with it, even like just seeing it, it somehow still sort of survives in some atomic level I don't understand.
Yeah.
but I like that as a kind of look, a way to shoot for instead of something in a book. Not that I mean, I always will love books and holding books mm-hmm. and sleeping on top of books and holding books like lovers to my chest all night long. But in terms of giving readings and putting myself out there publicly, I like the idea of staging things with other people and having it be a process.
In the roundtable discussion, we talked a little bit about the boundaries between genres and how to best teach new writers or writers who might be looking to submit to magazines like Colorado Review, how best to introduce them to genres or encourage them to write, and if taking down some of the boundaries is generative or overwhelming. And I was wondering, in your teaching or just in terms of the way you think about it, do you sort of have a side on that, or is that a thing that you're struggling with?
It's a thing I'm struggling with. I actually pitched a class once that I think exemplifies this struggle, which would have been, if I had taught it, the Oulipians versus the Surrealists. And if you don't know, if you know, Oulipo is just, you know, it's constraints. They call mm-hmm. themselves the rats who make the maze from which they must escape. Mm-hmm. And I love constraints as a writer. I crave them always. On the other hand, I love this idea of automatic writing. I love the idea of this sort of like terrifying liberty that some surrealist writing represents to me. Mm-hmm. I love and feel very strongly, how do I put this? I'm interested always in what I don't know and in how to access my unconscious. And I think that's what the surrealists can teach me when mm-hmm. I read them, that, you know, like, André Breton, mm-hmm. Robert Desnos, those are the people I'm thinking of. So as a teacher, I've tried both ways. I was telling you earlier, I tried to do an intro creative writing class where I was proudly proclaiming, there is no genre, genre's out the window. You know, we're all kind of like evolving towards something that's much more interesting. Mm-hmm. And that largely did not go well. And I think I see why now. I think I've always wanted a class like that. I've always wanted to take a class like that. Mm-hmm. But I also think back to when I was beginning to write and how much I loved forms, traditional forms and also open ones. I still do. And how much imitation meant to me. But especially I remember reading so many books on prosody and poetic forms mm-hmm. and poetics and theory and loving to learn deeply about the nature of the lyric, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I'm depriving my students of actual apprenticeship in this art form of poetry by saying we're doing everything. Mm-hmm. You know, at the same time, I think that it's a little bit limiting for me to think I'm going to write this poem because I don't. I think I'm going to write this impulse or I want to change something or figure mm-hmm. something out and it comes out in different ways. So I don't have an answer, mm-hmm. but I still would love to teach that class and do like half and half and then battle it out and sort of see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds fascinating. I think I could see the problem that maybe that knowledge is necessary in order to later, you know, deviate from genre norms. But on the other hand, how do you guarantee that there's a later? There's sort of like a problem that maybe everybody else that they, you know, who's teaching them is also going to teach them the forms, and then they never get to the sort of exciting being able to experiment and take down some of the boundaries.
A couple weeks ago in one of my classes, we were reading some sort of alternate fairy tales. We read some Grimm's, and then we read some like Carmen Maria Machado and some other people. And so, and then I, you know, the prompt was just to write a fairy tale. But it's not a fiction class. It's a nature writing class. It's a long story about why we're doing fairy tales, but it's absolutely fitting.
Yeah.
But two of the students wrote these fantastic poems. And it fit the assignment, but I hadn't expected poems, and I was so glad that I got those poems. And one student actually wrote more of a kind of nonfiction piece that just interrogated fairy tales altogether. So I was glad that they had that opening or that option, but they're also the three probably most accomplished writers in the class anyway, and they have that sense of autonomy and that I think most of the other people don't have yet because they're younger and less experienced.
And thinking of The Husband Stitch, I don't know if that was the one you read.
That's the one, yeah.
That's the one. It does use such hybrid mechanisms. There's stage directions that are so the webbing of the hand still like gives me shivers when thinking about. And I wonder about exactly that, because I think there's some poets and writers for whom the trajectory is an arrival at form, and of course like formalists like Richard Wilbur, for whom that is the end goal, and you pursue and achieve those forms as a fully realized poet or writer, and that operating within them and letting them be master of your writing is the thing that you ought to find, or is at least the thing that will free you to inhabit that vessel. That pre-exists you. And for others, it's in a movement away from them, innovating your own vessel, making for yourself, making anew. And so it feels like it's much like in a class where you have to cater both to those that are coming in with special knowledge, that are capable, that are gifted, that you want to give them the things that they most, enliven them, enliven their experience of writing. You also want to introduce those that have never picked up a pencil before or a pen, to what writing's about and why it's exciting. And so I think splitting the difference in terms of formalism and aformalism, in terms of genres being boundaries that they can work within and boundaries that they can do without, feels like an impossible thing to grapple with, but a worthy one to think about.
So well said, yeah. I also think just maybe this is flattening it a little bit, but I have a colleague, Penelope Pelazon, who is so good at teaching prosody. She's so good at teaching meter to intro to creative writing students and getting her students to write these beautiful iambic pentameter poems. And when I first started teaching at UConn, I would just beat myself up and like, why can't I get my students to do that? But it's just not who I am as a writer. And so I finally, after many semesters, like, no, I think the great thing is that students have an opportunity to work with different people, and I can only offer them where I am at that particular moment myself as a writer, and hope that they have many other experiences with people, not me.
Yeah. What was the process like in writing this novel after coming from primarily writing poetry? And was it strange to create something in a new form? And then once you had it, did you sort of have to ask yourself, what have I made and how will I put this out in the world?
I did think, oh gosh, what am I doing here? And I always ask, not how should I put this out in the world, but why? And I still have an uneasy relationship with that. I definitely don't try to publish everything I write. For God knows, I have so many things that should not and will not ever be submitted. So it's not like I think like if I've signed off on it, I'm putting it in an envelope. But I still ask myself all the time, like, why are you trying to do this? Hmm. And with writing Slater Orchard, it was a new sort of thing. So I was really happy to have an opportunity to publish it because it, you know, that's when you kind of get some distance from it and see maybe what it is more objectively. And I wanted that and needed that experience of seeing it objectively. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, I have a lot of poems that I have not collected into a book, but I also have already published books of poems and I know how I feel and I don't need to publish these other poems just because.
Yeah. Mm. For those listening that may be at different levels of that of their publishing careers, if they are contemplating individual poems they might send to Call It a Review or book-length collections that they might be thinking about sending to the Call It a Prize for Poetry, how do you determine for yourself? Is there a criteria that you have for what qualifies as vital, must enter the world, I want to enter the world, I want people to have eyes on, and which might just be for you or might not be any, like you just said, must never.
Right. Well, I think it depends on where you are in your writing life. Hmm. I think it's really important for emerging writers to try to get published because I think that's, one, how they can start to find their own communities of mm-hmm. people and readers, and also, two, how they can start to get some distance and perspective on their work. So I always encourage writers to send their work out to different journals. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, whether it should be or not, I think that's hard for a person just starting out. I think mm-hmm. do your best, have, you know, get some other eyes on it. But, I think that wasn't a question I asked myself, you know, even 10 years ago. I didn't ask myself why. I just said, like, how, where, you know. Yeah, sure. And I think the why comes later on. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to be with that question now, but I don't know if that would have been helpful a while back.
Do you remember what was your first, like, got in the mail, got news of a publication, either an individual piece or a larger piece that really just sent you up the wall and said, thank goodness, I've done it. I'm a writer. I've, you know.
Yeah, I do. New Zealand poet, Les Murray, who recently died. I don't know if you guys know him. Mm. He had come to my grad program and I really liked his work. He has this poem. He's talking in the voice of a herd of cows. I think it starts, all of me standing in a field, the skies are shining. I could be misquoting it, but I loved the idea of all of me was the pronoun he mm-hmm. had the cows using. I just thought he was really innovative while still being quite formal. My program was really formal and very, very like closed form, craft oriented, but he sort of was breaking out of it in interesting ways. And so, I mean, I was super young, I didn't know anything, but he said he would look at my poems for his journal in Australia, and it was, no one was ever going to read it. But he took one, and I was so happy.
Wow.
That it lived and died in Australia. I don't think I have a copy of it, but I'll never forget that because it was like somebody that I actually admired and knew I would feel something if they found would validate my work in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been the case ever since, to send to a journal where I don't know who the editors are and haven't read very much, even if it's prestigious, doesn't feel like anything. But if you know what kind of work they publish and like the writers they publish and like even maybe know some of the editors and the kinds of work they write, it's so cool.
Yeah.
There's a big difference.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah. I love that.
There's a fiction writer who just graduated. Her name is Alice, and she's a wonderful writer, writes really beautiful essays and stories. And I've talked with her about what she calls the thing, and that we each have a thing that we're writing about, and it's usually hard to articulate, but we've sort of guessed that you only write about that thing, that it might be in different forms, but it's all really getting at whatever that core thing, and that it's different for each person. But, and we're not sure, but we kind of think maybe not, doesn't change all that much over time. there's just sort of this thing that haunts you or whatever. Mm. Do you feel that way, or do you feel like you sort of bounce from subject to subject, that there's not one core thing that sort of has the gravity that pulls you back in?
No, I definitely feel that way. I never think when I'm writing something, oh, this is like everything else I've written, but it is.
If you were to try to describe the thing for you, what would it be? But again, if you don't want to answer that, because that can be, it's like your deepest fear, basically.
Partially, right, it's definitely your deepest fear. I think partially what I'm always interested in, although maybe it's not obvious, is the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And I think when I even think of that word, that compound word, I could just write for the rest of my life, because I'm writing towards what I don't know. But I also think coming of age when I did, and thinking about and reading like a lot of like nuclear Holocaust things, that idea of like total ruination, and I don't want to say apocalypse because that's too long to get into, but total ruination.
Because of etymology.
There's so much about that word. I mean, I know that's in the title of one of my books, but like I'm trying to move away from it. The threat of total ruin is really something that is grim and gripping, and especially like life and new life within that. Someone said to me after my first book was published, how many kids do you have? The person who was editing my first book before it was published asked me how many kids I had, and at the time I had none. She was like, oh, there's so many kids in this book, I just thought. And I mean, part of me was like, fuck, now I'm like, sorry, I won't say that in the
present. No, you're fine.
Like I'm, you know, now I'm like a, what am I, I'm a woman writer, shit, you know, but like, but I was like, I don't know why I'm writing about kids. I don't have any kids. Now, I mean, now I have kids, but I think it wasn't like kids or like motherhood. It was just like, why do we keep perpetuating life? And then how do you explain that, you know, it could all just blow up in a second?
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm writing about.
Oh gosh. And like you said, you could write about it forever.
Forever.
It's the unknown.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And in any form. I mean, you described it abstractly, and then it's kids who are life inside of the total ruin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. It makes me want to not go back to my hotel room and grade 15 more papers and instead just write. But I, since I'm being recorded, just want everyone in my department to know that I will be correcting those papers.
The afterlife can wait. Darcy, we can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Oh, thank you guys. Thank you, Evan, Danny. This is awesome.
As ever, Evan and I are indebted to Editor-in-Chief of Collaborator Review and Director of the Center for Literary Publishing, Stephanie Geschwind, for making this podcast possible. Thanks also to Arnie Geschwind for having composed the wonderful music that you heard during this episode. Sincerest thanks and a happy Thanksgiving to all those listening. We hope to have you back here in December.